Okay, so I'm going to answer the question of who Dogen was and what he was like by talking about my own experience as a cook at Dana Kosher in relation to his text, The Advice to the Tenzo. The Tenzo was the head cook in a Japanese monastery. And then I'm going to talk quite briefly about his life and times, and then we'll go and we'll hear the selection of readings from his life's work, which was called The Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. So, anyway, I came across Dogen through cooking at Dana Kosher. When I started to cook, I didn't plan this, I just fell into it as I tend to. When I started to cook, I could only cook seven recipes, and one of them was baked potatoes, you know. But time passed and I added to my repertoire, you know, and I wasn't totally focused on getting a meal on the counter. And people began to sort of say nice things about my cooking, you know, and I quite liked that. But then I began to wonder if it was wrong to distract the retreatants from the theme of the retreat by making sort of food that was a bit sort of posh, you know. So I tried plain and simple, but that didn't work either. I still got compliments. I thought, how bad has this got to be? So the compliments stopped. And then you thought, well, they're just going to go away and they're not going to come back to Dana Kosher. It's awful, you know. So anyway, once on a Sangha retreat, Surya Vangsa talked about the two poles of energy of a retreat. One was the shrine room and the other one was the kitchen. And that kind of, a penny kind of dropped with me then. I began to realize that what was going on out there on the retreat had to be matched by what was going on in here in the kitchen, that there was a sort of energy thing going on. And at the same time as he said that, I was having discussions with Vajrakridaya, who was the kitchen manager at the time. And he's a Padmasambhava practitioner. So he considered the kitchen and cooking as a cremation ground, which maybe was a kind of unfortunate metaphor. But I knew what he meant, you know. I can let that one pass, you know. So the kitchen is a good place to burn off a bit of ego. You don't cook the rice. You set up the conditions and the rice cooks. So step back from it. All sorts of people come into the kitchen to help you, and you've got to connect with them. And I was just beginning to get a feel for the fact that the whole kitchen at Dana Kosher things are much bigger and much deeper thing than I really originally anticipated. And I still had a lot of questions. And at that point, I discovered Dogen's text, Advice to the Tenzo. And on the very first page of this book, Dogen begins by quoting a much older text. I'll quote it to you. The function of a tenzo is to manage meals for the monks. Put your awakened mind to work, making a constant effort to serve meals full of variety that are appropriate to the needs and the occasion, and that will enable everyone to practice with their bodies and minds with the least hindrance. Then Dogen goes on to say that down through the ages, many great teachers and patriarchs have served as tenzo. And although the work is just that of preparing meals, it is in spirit different from an ordinary cook or kitchen helper. And the words, it is in spirit different, that just kind of clicked with me. I began to see this is what I was getting a wee glimpse of. Because I understood what he meant, and he really had me hooked. And I was beginning to get some sense of this in the kitchen. And I was finding that working there was immensely satisfying. And I felt that I was sort of making an offering to the three jewels just by cooking. And I'm not very good at sorting these kind of things out myself. I just was getting these kind of feelings that that's what it felt like. But I'm not good at getting it all analysed and sorted. So I was really glad to find that I had Dogen to rely on. Dogen went on to comment that if a man entrusted with the work lacks such a spirit, then he will only endure unnecessary hardship and suffering that will have no value in his pursuit of the way. So it's quite important to be in the right spirit, or you're just not doing yourself any good or anybody else. I'll let him away with the man bit because he was talking to monks. However, what he seemed to be saying was importantly. Firstly, I felt that cooking was helping me to progress on the path. Because it is a challenging activity, and keeping it all calm and joyful is largely a function of my own energy. And my energy is a function of how deep my practice is, and by sort of living on the edge of what I could handle as far as my own depth of practice is concerned, it helped my practice to deepen. Secondly, and this is something Dogen's Tenzo didn't have to deal with, there are retreatants who come into the kitchen to help me. In the early days, I would look at the next bunch on a Friday night and groan inwardly, you know, and like, oh, no, I really don't want to make friends with another 25 people, you know. Keep them out of my hair, you know. And so I would somehow sort of drag up some energy to sort of reach out to them, and by the end of the week we were best mates. This used to happen. This was sort of wheel of life stuff, you know. Friday night, oh no, you know. Next Thursday, big hugs, and everybody's going, you know. As time passed, I noticed that the oh no effect got less and less and less, and just disappeared. It was quite nice to sort of have that as a touchstone that your practice was getting deeper. That something that you had found difficult wasn't so difficult. But it was only by being there with the difficulty that you get it sorted. And the other, on the theme of reaching out to people, obviously this repeatance is the retreat team. And I find a lot of how my energy goes in the retreat depends on my connection with the retreat team. It's not a huge connection, it's usually the organiser, because that's, from a practical point of view, who you see most of. And I find that it's how I relate to the retreat team has a huge effect on my energy, and it's a salutary lesson to me that I'm not an island, and I'm linked into that system. And if I'm not well connected, I find a struggle. Again, if I can quote Dogen again, it's the same bit that I've read already. If he lacks such a spirit, then he will only endure unnecessary hardship and suffering, which will have no value in his pursuit of the way. And it seems that I need these connections to get that wavelength going. And if I do, and it all just goes, and it's that happy energy, and it's very sort of creative, you get into the place which Dogen describes as you consider yourself fortunate to have been born as a human being, given the opportunity to prepare meals for the three jewels. Our attitude should truly be one of joy and gratefulness. And that's what it feels like. It does feel it's joyful, and you're really grateful that you can be there and do it. Thirdly, it's not everyone that comes through the kitchen door that's going to become my best pal. Well, no, we'll have no names and no pack drill on this one, but I have met a few people who've really pressed my buttons, and I have lost the plot on more than one occasion. It's not happened for a long time, but I'm not going to tempt fate by saying it's not going to happen again. It's a real edge for me to recognise the common humanity between myself and someone whose values and thought processes are very far forth from mine. But just to recognise them, and you get people, and they just come in, and they're really difficult, and you've still got to accept them. They're another human being, and it's that I can't always do. I'm hitting that. It's just, but it's that's where the edge is at the moment, and it's quite good. Anyway, I'll finish this part of the talk by one of my favourite. I could read chunks from the advice to the Tenzo all night. I could just stand here and read. Dodge of it, because it's a text I really love. But we'll finish this bit, which is a bit about me cooking, with a last quote from the advice to the Tenzo, which is, the way-seeking mind of a Tenzo is actualized by rolling up your sleeves. In other words, get in there and do it. And that was pretty much all I knew about Dogen until I started preparing this talk. I knew that one text, I knew it well. I've left it in the shrine. It's dog-eared and fallen to bits. Advice to the Tenzo is one of a group of instructions that Dogen wrote. He wrote quite different works. He wrote poetry, he wrote, they're really plain and they're simple and clear, and he takes you by the hand and tells you what to do. And I was absolutely gobsmacked when I found the breadth and variety of his writings. He is one of the giants of the Zen tradition. They wrote a huge amount. Anyway, well, first, next thing is I want to just kind of place Zen Buddhism in the kind of general Buddhist history, so that we just know where it's coming from. So, to do that, we'll start back at the time of the Buddha. The great gathering in Vulture's Peak. There's monks and nuns and lay men and lay women and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and gods and all the usual suspects have gathered because the Buddha's about to give a discourse. And I mean, you've got to think what a discourse was in these days. They're not all sitting there with their clipboards and their pens because they don't write. Nor have they got their iPhones turned on to record. If you miss a word, you miss it. It's gone. So you're all sitting there really keyed up and agog, waiting on this discourse. And the Buddha doesn't say anything. He simply holds up a golden flower. Not a word. You know, they're all, you know. And one of his monks, Mahakashyapa, gets it. And he smiles. And he becomes enlightened in that moment. And the Buddha then entrusted this special transmission outside the scriptures to Mahakashyapa. And this heart-to-heart transmission was passed on through 28 Indian patriarchs. And the 28th was Bodhidharma, who's also on our refuge team. And Bodhidharma went to China. And he passed it on through 6 Chinese patriarchs. And the 6th Chinese patriarch was Huineng, who just went ballistic. He passed it on to 43 people. And the Rinzai and Soto Zen sects of Japan trace their lineage back to 2 different people of that 43. So they trace it back, they have an unbroken heart-to-heart transmission that goes all the way back to the Buddha. And it's quite a sort of important aspect of the Zen tradition. Anyway, in the centuries following the introduction of Buddhism to China, Chan, as Zen Buddhism is called in China, became the largest sect of Chinese Buddhism. And the teachers who followed Huineng began to sort of branch out and have their own little schools and variations on the theme developed as they do. But they all had the same basic focus, which was meditation practice, personal instruction, and personal experience. And some of these schools spread to Japan. And the schools of Zen that are currently exist in Japan are Soto, Rinzai, and Obaku. Of these, Soto is the largest and Obaku is the smallest. And Zen was not introduced to Japan until the 12th century, which was just when Dogen was born. The first one to appear was Rinzai. And then in 1215, Dogen journeyed to China himself. And after his return, he established the Soto Zen school. Although he wouldn't actually have been awfully happy to hear me say that, because he didn't like this my sect, your sect, you know. He was very against that. I mean, he once said, no Buddha or patriarch ever spoke of a Zen sect. Those who pronounce a devil's appellation must be confederates of the devil, not children of the Buddha. He called himself a Dharma transmitter monk. And that was, he felt he was teaching the Buddha Dharma, and that was it. He didn't like the sect thing. Anyway, for some reason or other, we all like to know where he was born and who his daddy was and all this stuff. So, and I do too. Anyway, he was born in Kyoto, which was the capital of Japan at the time, in 1200. And to put this in a historical context, in a European historical context, largely European, William the Lion was king of the Scots, and he was squabbling with England about Northumberland. Richard the Lion-hearted of England had just died, and King John would soon be faced with having to sign the Magna Carta. The Moors and the Christians were slugging it out in Spain. It was 5-4 on penalties to the Christians at that point. The Fourth Crusade was in progress, and Genghis Khan had just invaded China. So not exactly peaceful times, and not exactly peaceful times in Japan either. because Japan was changing. That although the court still retained much of its political power, the samurai had set up a rival administration, sort of based on peasant simplicity, in Kamakura. And Dogen's father was the most influential minister in the imperial court, and his mother was the daughter of a former regent of the court. And he himself was a child prodigy. He could read when he was three, and he could read and understand complex philosophical works by the time he was six. So he was well connected, he was talented, and he was expected to follow his father into government office. But his father died when he was three, and his mother died when he was eight. And having to face the realities of that sort of loss, really, just as a young child, turned him towards Buddhism and away from the important position that his birth and talents and his family expected him to take up. So at the age of 12, he ran away from home, and he travelled by night so that he wasn't detected. He sort of went forth like the Buddha. You know, the Buddha was a grown man. You know, this was only a wee boy, you know. So he ran away and he went to Mount Hiei, which was a great Buddhist centre where his uncle was a monk. I think his uncle tried to persuade him to go back, but you know, 12-year-old boys are like, he just wouldn't have it. So they let him stay, and the following year he was ordained. Not into a Buddhist tradition, into the Tendai tradition, which wasn't Zen, well, not into the Zen tradition, into the Tendai tradition, which was a form of Buddhism that was not Zen. Zen was just not quite into it. But they were one of the schools that believed that you were inherently enlightened, and you just, there's two theories. One, that enlightenment's something you work towards, or two, that you are inherently enlightened, and you have to unfold and uncover this enlightenment. The Tendai believed that you are inherently enlightened. And this confronted Buddha Dogen with a compelling question, which was that both the exoteric and esoteric teachings explain that a person in essence has true Dharma nature and is originally a body of Buddha nature. If this is so, why do all Buddhas of the past, present and future arouse the wish for enlightenment and bodhicitta and seek enlightenment? And, you know, this is a really valid question, because that's the rock that these kind of schools, such as the Soto Zen and the Tendai school, perish on. If I'm essentially enlightened already, then I don't need to do anything. Instead of getting up early and meditating, I'll just lie in my bed. So Dogen really wanted an answer to this, and he wasn't getting one at Mount Hiei. So he went to one of the other big monasteries in Japan, which was another centre of the Tendai school. And the abbot there didn't give him an answer, but he suggested he should go to China, which was a hazardous journey at that point, because remember, Genghis Khan was on the rampage by this time. However, Dogen went to a monastery where he met a monk who had already been to China and brought some Rinzai teachings. And he studied with him, and also with one of his disciples, who was called Myozen. And then Myozen and Dogen went to China. A very difficult journey, but off they went. And he visited most of the major monasteries in southern China. And these were generally using koans, which I think most of you last week, enigmatic questions, the sound of one hand clapping, does a dog have Buddha nature? And you just sit and think about this question day in, day out, night in, night out, until something breaks. Your mind just stops trying to solve it logically. And they really went in for this system. But Dogen wasn't mad keen on this. He didn't really like it. He felt that the masters were too focused on the koans and on the students' response to them, and they weren't really paying enough attention to the Buddhist scriptures. So he was a bit disappointed with what he was getting in China, to the extent that when one of the masters offered them a Dharma transmission, he politely refused it. I would love to have been a fly in the ceiling. You've got this Zen master who decides, I will give that promising young monk a Dharma transmission, and he turns around and says, well, no thanks. Yeah, I think Gallus is a word in Glasgow. Anyway, he was considering returning to Japan and not having found anything in China that suited him, when somebody told him about a teacher called Naiojo and said he was the only authentic practitioner of the way, so Dogen went off to study with him. And Naiojo was quite an unconventional character. He never wore the ornate brocade robes that his position entitled him to. And I mean, they were ornate, because you go online and Google Kisa, and it's amazing what you get. You don't get little things like this. You get these fantastic embroidered silk robe things, you know, they're quite flash. But anyway, Naiojo just had nothing to do with this. He just wore a very plain robe. And he discouraged his students from being intimate with kings and ministers. He kept them out of politics. And he denied that there were five Zen schools, each with their own teaching. He said that what he was teaching was the great way of all the Buddhas. And he taught a method of meditation called Shikan Taza, which is a sort of single-minded, just-sitting type of practice. And he discouraged other practices, saying that the study of Zen was the dropping away of body and mind. Or in Dogen's words, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things of the universe. To be enlightened by all things of the universe is to cast off the body and mind of the self, as well as those of others. Even the traces of enlightenment are wiped out, and life with traceless enlightenment goes on forever and ever. In less than a year, Naiojo considered that Dogen had achieved direct realization that he was enlightened. And in his own words, he had completed his life study of the great matter. So he returned to Japan and to the Tendai community that he had left. And he made it clear that he intended to teach Zen meditation, as he learned with Naiojo, and rather than the mixed practices taught by the Tendai. And the Tendai didn't like this at all, quite hostile to that idea. And the hostility forced Dogen to move from Kyoto. So in the next year, he wrote one of the first sort of weighty texts that he was going to write, one called On the Endeavour of the Way. And it was his first attempt to explain Zen teachings in Japan, and he wrote it in Japanese. And at that time, scholarly works in Japan were generally written in Chinese. So he was kind of serving notice that he wanted this to have a much wider audience. It wasn't just the posh educated people that were able to read it, but anyone who could read Japanese could read this text. So it was a bit of breaking with tradition, you know, a sharp intake of breath from the powers that be. And he also argued against the prevailing view that Buddhism can be divided into three periods: the true Dharma, the imitative Dharma, and the decayed Dharma. And a lot of the Japanese had the view that they were living in the age of the decayed Dharma. And he said it didn't matter when you lived, you could achieve the way. And it's easy to see all this sort of animosity between him and the Tendai establishment. It's all sort of, when you read it in a book, it's all cut and dried and very matter-of-fact now, 800 years later. But, you know, I wonder what it was really like at the time. You know, here was this 30-year-old monk contradicting the sort of time-honoured views of the Buddhist masters, advocating a single practice form of Buddhism and writing in Japanese. You know, they probably thought he was an argumentative, opinionated young whippersnapper, you know. You lose all that, so you lose all the emotion, you know. You lose the blood and guts when you've got that length of time. And I quite like that, because in a way it parallels our movement. I mean, there are people about who think that Bhante's a bit of a maverick. And it's just not like that. We're at the beginning of a movement. I mean, 40 years is a blink of an eye. And I'm sure things for Dogen weren't easy, and they weren't all sort of cut and dried and simple and emotionless. I feel it was a bit roughy-toughy, you know. Anyway, and he founded a practice centre, and he started writing The Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, other sections. And later, a monk's hall was built, and that's when he wrote the instructions for the Tenzo, in order to establish, you know, monastic regulations for his temple. And during that period, a monk called Ijo joined him. And he began transcribing the informal lectures that Dogen gave his monks, and they were added to the treasury of the true Dharma eye. And in a way, Ajo stands in the same relation to Dogen as Ananda did to the Buddha. He was, and as Free Buddhist Audio does to us. It's true. Different, you know. And anyway, 1242 finds Dogen with a community of monks writing prolifically. He completed 17 sections of the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye in that year. That's one every 3 weeks. He was turning the stuff out, you know. But anyway, the Tendai hierarchy were still nipping at his heels, so he moved again. He moved to Ehi Zen province, and this monastery is still in existence. It was a cold and mountainous region. It sounds a bit like Danakosia in December. But the students started right away building a full-scale practice centre. And while this was going on, Dogen was giving them discourses. Ajo was writing them down and adding them to the True Dharma Eye. So the whole thing was really kind of building up. When I read this bit of Dogen's life story, you know, I went off on a wee flight of fancy. I thought, you know, Danakosha in December, you know, the water pipe sometimes freezes and the snow brings the electric power cables down and you end up having to check the potatoes with the stuff in the oven, the roast tatties and a flashlight. And I thought, but there's been a tenzo who probably had the same problems, you know, the well froze, you know, the oil for the lamps went solid, you know, and I thought, it really felt nice that there's been these parallel difficulties. I'm not wishing that on the poor guy, but, you know, parallel difficulties. So the next time I find myself faced with a frozen water pipe or no electricity, I'll not get grumpy about it, I promise. Anyway, this time we're getting quite close to the end of Dogen's life. He didn't live that long. In 1247, he was asked by the regent to come to Kamakuru and give them a lecture. So it's a wee sort of straw in the wind that by that time he was established and accepted by the powers that be. I mean, I've been drawing parallels here and there, and the only parallel I can think of this one is that Suryavansa gets invited through to Edinburgh to give Alexander the Dharma talk, you know. So we'll need to work on that. And shortly after that, he became ill and he died the following year. And, but he left us this enormous group of texts. And it's not the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, it's not like one book, you know, chapter one, chapter two. It's a series of different kinds of texts, which are gathered together because of the common thread that they're one author. Some of them, as we've seen from the instructions to the Tenzo, are really quite simple and straightforward, and you know, you just can't miss it. Some of them are very philosophical, and even when you're reading bits, it's a familiar concept of Buddhism, you understand it intellectually, even if you don't get the hang of it otherwise. But he's got a sort of edgy way of writing about it. So it's quite challenging and provocative. And then he writes stuff where he depends very heavily on poetic imagery. And it's like 5-page koans. They're huge. And there's no way you're going to understand them logically. It just doesn't work that way. And he also wrote poetry. So it really is. It's a fantastic. I've got the book that's lying on the shrine, the Moon and the Dewdrop, is bits from the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, and it's worth a look. It's just so many different kinds, and it's a look into an enlightened mind. I don't expect to understand it. I don't. But I was really quite gobsmacked when I saw just how much he'd done. Because I had known the one text so well, I had developed a preconceived idea of Dogen. It was actually quite wrong. So I'm going to go away after this talk and read a lot more. I've become quite interested in him. So, but that's it. So I think that's about us. Feeling it, barring any questions, we can go next door and just hear little bits, very different little bits, to give you a kind of idea of just the variety of stuff this guy could write. So, that's us.
Thank you very much.